Have you ever heard anyone rave about church like they rave about Leichhardt Oval? You know, as a spiritual experience.
Yeah, nothing.
And people don't like it, but sport is the new religion. Stadiums are the new cathedrals. But there's a scientific side of it as well, particularly when you go out. Why do we go out to these stadiums? And it's because oxytocin gets generated in the air. There's a communal drug. So what we're really most interested in, we don't even know it subconsciously, is the fact that sports are a Catherine wheel spitting out storytelling archetypes. In one team, you might have 10.
Sport has always been more than just a game. But what if it's actually replaced religion for a lot of us? Today's guest sees sport through a lens most of us feel but struggle to articulate. Patrick Skeen is an award-winning author, journalist and storyteller who explores where sport, history and culture collide. His book, Celestial Footy, The Story of Chinese-Australian Participation in Aussie Rules, won the Australian Society for Sports History Public Book Prize. And in 2025, he was ranked second in the world on LinkedIn in the sports journalist category. In this conversation, we go deep into why sport is the last truly bipartisan space in modern life, how a new season gives us hope, renewal and meaning, and why you can often tell who's played team sport just by how they handle adversity. We talk storytelling, the hero's journey, redemption arcs, those emotional moments when players ring their parents to say, "I've made it," and why sport has the power to bring people together across background, belief and identity like nothing else. If sport has ever given you hope, perspective, or a reset when life needed one, you'll feel this episode deeply. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport, as I see it, is to see your vision become a reality. Find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. Patrick, how are you going?
Every day's a lesson, mate. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome, mate. Oh, goosebumps already. On your profile, one of the things that really stood out is like daily gratitude and how important that is. And even just from the conversation we've had before we hit record, I can just tell you you're a real wise old soul that, well, the storytelling is one thing, but you've got a way that you connect with people immediately, and I really appreciate that.
I think parenting has really helped that for me, having to re-articulate things that are fundamental to me back to my kids and see if they make sense or not. And, you know, they say fatherhood brings grey hair, but also brings wisdom as well. So, yeah, I am constantly sharpening and grateful for everything. We just even the ability to play sport in peace is a grand, and watch sport in peace is a grand luxury. And I've travelled a lot and really appreciate the role that sport has.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, fatherhood certainly does that. When I realised that actually they're teaching me, well, it was a bit of a shift. Have you had any lessons from your children that really felt profound?
One lesson I get from my son is just to go for it.
Nice.
I have a perfectionist streak, so I don't like to start anything until it's perfect. And, you know, perfection is the enemy of progress. And it's, you know, how many great projects haven't we seen in the world? The great movies, the great songs, because someone wanted to get it 100% right.
Yeah.
But he throws himself into things with a zeal that I didn't have. I developed a little bit more chutzpah later on in life, but I just love his... Like, we're only on here for a short term. We're on a rock hurtling 1,600 kilometres... an hour through the universe. It's 10 trillion to one that we're sitting here right now. And, you know, why be a wallflower when we get these 120 years max to do great things? And I'm just re-energized by him. He was in acting class on the weekend, which, you know, when I grew up was just, it wasn't an option where I grew up and in a sport obsessed world. And we looked at the drama guys as, you know, alien creatures. Cool, kind of cool in a way, but it was that other world. I saw he's playing sport and he's doing other things, and I just saw him throw himself into acting. And it's like, yeah, that's it. Just who cares? Failure is It's such a subjective thing when you're gathering experience, and you hear from all the Gretzky's and the Jordans, and they all seem to have a commonality in the way they treat failure as this springboard and an exciting thing to fail, to know your limitations, to know you have to change something, almost as if it's the essence of life.
Yeah,
and to move towards those, embrace the failures as the ultimate teacher. I find that thinking fascinating, rather than being so scared of failure and so scared in public that you never activate that great thing that you were destined to do.
Yeah, that's part of the human makeup. I'm most fascinated in. I love diving into all of the different unique features of individuals and what makes them tick. And yeah, it is fascinating. What is it about them? I think just looking at those guys in particular, I think there's an element of trauma that creates that. You know, people describe Michael as almost sociopathic in his desire. Now, I don't know if that's...
Kobe, I'm reading Kobe stories as well, like his best mates with a guy in the Team USA camp and then slaughtering him 2 weeks later, no quarter given, elbows to the ribs, absolute hard ass, as if, you know, that 2 weeks before didn't happen. So definitely, I mean, people have to accept that most elite sports people come with a certain personality that eliminates every bit of unnecessary fat in their personal life. Yep. You know, people feel they're getting snubbed, and it's like, no, when you're so single-minded, you've just got to ruthlessly cast every possible distraction aside. And that Mamba mentality of, and I saw Michael Jordan in his documentary basically made up some stuff that an opposing player said to get himself motivated, made it up, put it in the journo's thing. This poor guy's thinking, you know, didn't know at the time, but he's being used as a motivational stooge by Michael Jordan. And it's like, I don't want, you know, that's the difference between elite and guys who turn up on a Sunday in a way. Like, I don't think you look at any Australian sporting team, they're not the best 11 players of that sport, of that country. They're the best 11 players that have a ruthlessness, had parents that were prepared to drive them around, you know, in a grueling representative cycle, devote their lives to the kids 5 days a week. There's a whole lot of variables that get them to the top. They're the most disciplined, maybe. They may be the most well-supported. They may be the most mentored. They may be the ones that had judicious interventions from above at certain times in their cycle. But I've seen some kids, and I watch a hell of a lot of grassroots sport. That's where I find my highest layers of meaning these days. Yeah. When you know they're not playing for money. When you know someone's doing anything for love, you just embrace the whole thing in a different way.
Yeah, I love that. That's actually my first foray into business, was thinking about how do I create a pathway for those athletes that get missed, that don't have parents that can drive them everywhere, that don't necessarily have the funds. Like, you look at football, soccer at the moment, to get into the elite level, the price tag is ridiculous, like in the thousands, and you just wonder how many kids miss out because they just can't afford it.
And whilst there is always room for the late bloomers, pretty much if you're not in the pathways, you've got to sneak in the tradesman's entrance through some extraordinary path. So, and that can be a bit demeaning for some people. And the thing is, when you're playing in a sport, you actually know who the best guys are. And when you see certain rep teams get picked and certain people get left out, it's emotional.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, this is how we connected, the emotion of sport. You did a post, and you do one every day, you said to me, 7 a.m. And if anyone doesn't follow Patrick, make sure you have a look at his LinkedIn link in the show notes, because every day he has some of the most interesting, inspiring, emotional stories. And yeah, it's like we talked about before we jumped on, LinkedIn is a space where that sort of stuff's really celebrated. You're not going to get negativity on those sort of things, but your stuff is captivating. And the one in particular where we connected, where I reached out, was you were talking about sport is life and how much of a training ground it is for the rest of our life. What was, I know you have a marketing agency. What was the inspiration to actually make that sports side of things the singular focus in your storytelling?
Because you can link sport across to business without being too cheesy. I mean, you know, what my Cocoa Pops told me, Cocoa Pops this morning told me about B2B sales. We're done with that. But I can tell when I see, I'm in team environments and work on a lot of major sporting tournaments. We work on the Women's Asian Cup right now, which is being held in Australia.
Yep.
I can tell whether people have played team sport or not as a rough guide on how they handle adversity and how they handle no. And how they handle feedback, because if you get dropped by a sporting coach, you can talk all you want. You're boiling up and you've got to go and sit in, play for the reserves for 5 weeks and work your way back into the team. And you learn to take accountability. You learn not to blame other people. It's on you and you've got to work yourself back in. And I see people now when they get their first no in life. If you play sport, you've had hundreds. You've had the down times. You've overcome self-doubt with your injuries. You've been dropped when you thought you shouldn't be dropped. You've been given a reprieve when you know you should have gone down. You have all of these things that are built in, just those green spaces in every village, every suburb. Yeah. They just teach those things relentlessly. And sport is the great leveler. You get 100 one week in cricket and you get a duck the next. There's so much there. And if you come, that's why people like employing Olympians. They like employing people. When I know a lot of HR people want to know that someone played sport or committed to something where you can lose, even if it's chess, dancing, choir, the choirs, anything that involves teamwork and losing is such an enormous teacher. And prep for us. If you go through school, your kids, maybe parents shielded you from sport, or your competition may have, think that competition's not good and unhealthy because you might get embarrassed if you lose. Well, it's going to come for you later.
Yeah.
And it's come for you in a magnitude and you won't be prepped. Whereas the most of us who's played sport our whole life, we're doomsday preppers. We're ready for anything. We've got the nuclear bunker in the backyard and the tinned food because we've seen it all. When you're supposed to win one year and it's all your way and you get too cocky and some underdog comes from nowhere and cuts you down, or you're that underdog one day and you get on one of those streaks or missions. You see them in different sports where someone comes from fifth or sixth, and Balmain Tigers, I think it was 89, just came from all the way back and they just looked an unstoppable mission, and men that looked mortal looked immortal. And I'm really thrilled now that women are sharing that part of the world. Women are playing sport, getting into it, not just for their looking better and cardio and health, and all those are obviously tangible benefits, but they're benefits you can get in solo exercising as well.
Yep.
But just the feeling of the new season, the regeneration, this is our year. The 18-year-old kid, girl or boy, that gets picked in the draft that's going to turn your fortunes around. It in many ways has replaced religion. But it has, because religion offers you a fresh start in many ways. In Catholicism, if you say your confession, you start again. By even joining a religion, I'm off to on whatever the religion is. Sport offers that, but it also offers an unbelievable new hope every year. And the hope may be we won't come last. Will come second last. There's a whole lot of unbelievable mini goals, because if it's just on winning, like you look at the NFL is coming to a conclusion now, 32 teams, one wins. 31 will at some level have considered themselves failures. That means basically 3% of the fans of that sport are happy. The rest are scratching their heads. What happened? And the sports history is a door that turns on tiny hinges. You look at all the NFL games or rugby league games, Reece Walsh doesn't intercept Pappenhausen in last year's NRL grand final. Then, the Penrith dynasty, or the Storm Penrith dynasty just continues on in another shape or form. But that little one intervention by a great player, and anyone that knows rugby league knows, Reece Walsh scored tries, but that one thing where he anticipated that pass was a piece of instinctive genius that separates the million-dollar players from the parkies. It was just an unbelievable life, forged in touch footy. All of the experience he's had in life was brought to bear in that one moment. And when you love sport, you think, what about that guy's trainers, his school teachers, his coaches? They're all sitting on that because they added the ingredient to that piece of success on the journey. So when someone succeeds on the field, there's a whole ecosystem whose time and energy is validated, that they put their little thing into the development of this person. And that's why sport, we're seeing more and more of those videos where they bring the parents in for their debut, and I'm like, every time it gets me. More, yeah. You know, because, all right, we can watch a sad movie and, you know, mm-hmm. I can feel it when, you know, the car drives away in the bridges of Madison County or the coin goes up the wall in Ghost. And I'm there. But to see often incredibly humble working class parents were seeing their kid, they saw from a little munchkin all the way up and had all the ups and downs and doubts, and to see them, there's nothing more real on earth for me than that. And that's why I land at sport, because the stakes are so high that it's such an achievement to get there that it's just overwhelming, particularly in sports where there's money like rugby league, where you mm-hmm. you can actually see before your eyes an extended family's financial trajectory just change overnight. Some kids are going to go to private schools. People are going to get to operations earlier to extend grandparents' lives, and people can get the best of healthcare. And that's why I wrote my first book, The Big O. Here we are. The Life and Times of Olsen Filipina, which was, again, you write things and you end up doing all the learning. you come in as an expert, but you end up doing all the learning. But just to see the extended family and how much joy, and there's pressures. Oh, yeah, double-edged sword. There's pressures on those kids as well. But just to see sport intervening in communities like the Polynesian community through contact sport, not just rugby league, rugby union, martial arts and combat sports, and the NFL. NFL's 5% of Division I college are Polynesian kids.
Yeah, wow.
All from this tiny American Samoa that went to Hawaii and then settled in Utah and settled in California. And now they're the only group that's been able to make any sort of sizable inroads into the African-American and white demographic of the NFL.
Yeah, wow.
So sport provides this emotion, and LinkedIn is generally devoid of emotion. So why not brighten people's day and escape for a minute in a video that makes you feel fantastic about the world? Because LinkedIn is the best of humanity. When you're tied to your employment, you're going to lie less. You're going to be less passive-aggressive. You're going to be less and I can say that's changed with this American electoral situation. It's now being polluted. But in the little world you can curate, because you can block. If people come for you and they're not interested in your content, they just want to attack you, you have the luxury of removing those people from your life.
Yeah, you've got that in your profile. You say something along those lines, words, but if you come at me, you'll be removed. That's good. Oh, I love it.
You've come into my art gallery.
Yeah.
And you farted.
You're out.
You're rude, and I don't have to have you there. This is where my work, you know, this is my gallery of stories that are up to a certain demographic. I'm uplifted by them, and they're uplifted by them. I'm not making any of this up. I'm just reporting a lens on what happens. And there's just these negative people who, in your real life, unfortunately, unless they're family or you're sitting next to them in an office cubicle. But I don't have to have you in my life if you haven't been able to handle those negative demons and are destroying, trying to bring people down, tall poppy syndrome, whatever. There's a number of ways people describe it. Not interested. Life's too short. And the worst thing is it vampires your energy. I've got to think of some sort of comeback to say to this guy because I'm in front of everyone. I don't want to look weak. And it's like, actually, no. If I delete that comment and block that guy, no one else is thinking about it ever again. It's just this thing that happened back in the ether. And guess what? That negative influence is no longer there. So that's why I'm on LinkedIn. I don't post on X anymore. I used to, I remember one time coming out of a meeting so infuriated with what one guy said in my old Twitter days that we left a business meeting because I had what I thought was a zinger and sort of firing back and forth with some guy on an irrelevant thing. And I said, this is it. This is a life moment. I'm going to not post on X anymore. Love the guys that do, and I love the guys with the thick skins. And sometimes you just want to go on there and have a battle. I'm up for it. But as you get older, you realize that stuff can impact your work. It impact how you treat family, and you know, do you want to be a force for light or a force for darkness? Do you want to be someone that people shy away from because you're filled with hate-filled opinions, as much as you may think they're true, or do you want to have people gravitate towards you because they feel somehow you've mastered the Zen being more positive, more positive than negative, and people then want to feed off some positive energy. And there's plenty of people I like to feed off as well that somehow just through crisis and triumph just stay that same level-headed person, and they're excellent to be around.
Yeah,
I've been watching an old series called Hornblower.
Yeah,
which is about old C.S. Forrester novels about life on ships in the 1750s. And you're in these tiny little bunks underneath with other humans for weeks and weeks and months and months on half rations. Now, they talk this new concept called hangry. You know, I'm angry when I'm when I'm hungry. Just imagine being and limited showering. So it's just a festival of bad smells. You're all over each other. You're hangry on half rations. You've got to perform the, but these whole ships, because everyone did their thing perfectly in teamwork. Because if some guy lets, one person lets down on a ship, you go over a reef, or you're all, because you couldn't swim. Like the stakes of having to get along for, and I see some parallels, not as dramatic, but I see that in sport. You set off on a galleon at the start of the year and you've got that shared mission for 1 year. There'll never be that shared mission. There'll never be an identical team like that. Something will change. Your opponents will change. This is a, you know, a one-time set of variables, and you lock in. You may have a weakness in some, you're trying to shore up, or others have got you on, but you just go on that sense of shared mission. And I just have never felt anything like that. Even down in Thirsty Thirds playing rugby, the start of a new season was just like, there's an old saying I picked up from a series called Dexter, which was, there's nothing a new city can't cure. You know what I mean? That's the same with a new season. Start. It doesn't matter what happened last year. There's nothing a new season can't 100%. Cure for horrors, because we're all 0-0-0-0 in the table at the start, and we're off on a journey. And who knows? Maybe the 18-year-old kid that came down with the, you know, the goofy haircut could actually be. And the best thing is, it forces. I remember I was 17 playing a decent level cricket. And I remember sitting there with 35-year-old guys who in any other environment wouldn't give me the time of day, because I'm just a wet behind the ears, young buck. But I remember, because I had a partnership with these guys and we had a shared adventure together in the middle, we became besties. And that guy guided me through my, you know, early 20s with just advice and wisdom. And there's no way we could have connected unless you have to share something together. You can go and have coffees with people once a month, which is a traditional, you know, keep in touch with someone model. But if you sign up for a season of any sport, go and play squash with them, you go on these shared adventures that actually build. It's the consistent reinforcement that builds relationships. It's the turning up at 7 o'clock. And I coach in cricket. I'll be up next Saturday. I'm on off the red eye from Perth from something I'm doing over there for Football Australia at 6 a.m. And then I'm 7-8 o'clock down at the field in St. George coaching. And people say, why would you do that? It's like, you don't understand. You can't let anyone down on the mission. There's nothing worse than anyone pull. You know, like, even when you're wounded, you finish the season and then you reassess, but you've got to see that ship through the reefs. And I looked on the ships, like, you can't pull out on a ship.
No.
You can't just say, I've got a hammy or I've got whatever. You must get up every day in the worst weather. You got to go up on the masts and whatever. And I thought, yeah, that's what every year, it's a ship we all hop on for a sport, whether you're a fan of, like this year, I support two teams. I have an Australian team, the Bulldogs, and a New Zealand team, the Warriors. That's my excuse, but I love them both. I'm a pure Dogs man, but writing the book about Olsen Filipina, I fell in love with the Warriors, and they haven't won, and I just think they are the very, very essence of the rugby league fan, their loyalty and passion. So yeah, shout out to the
Wires. Yeah, so good. I'm madly writing all these different ideas, and you jump into something else, and I'm like, oh, where do I go from here? The things that you talked about, the parents, the video with the parents, then telling them, it's not just the parents' emotion. You can tell from the player how emotional they are to tell their parents, because it's almost like a, even if they don't say it, it's an acknowledgement of thank you for driving me everywhere or being on this journey with me. Yeah, that I'm the same. Grabs me every time.
But you see it in the players as well. I mean, they're just on this shared enterprise where it's love,
Oh, their teammates. Know,
men
can, yeah.
Men in
yeah.
particular can express their feelings. It's been a huge lack in us. And for women, sport is, there's a lot of competitive women, and it's harnessing that into something really good and positive. And, you know, as I said before, I'm so glad women now, when they hit the workplace, are seasoned by sport and ready for any, oh, what's this? All right, I didn't get that promotion. But remember when I, you know, spent 9 months rehabbing my meniscus? I've been through the valley of death, so nothing can touch me now. And that resilience piece I find super fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned, that was another thing I wrote down, actually. You talked about players being able to share their emotions. To me, that's what drives those people on places like Twitter that want to fight, is that we're a nation that's traditionally suppressed emotions. And so it still needs a pathway. It still needs to get out. And that's what ends up happening, right? They're externalizing their frustration in those places. Whereas the antidote to that is in a sporting environment where, yeah, it's actually okay. You can share the whole range of emotions, whether you're a fan, a player. Obviously, some people can take that too far, and I can definitely say I've been one of those people on the sporting field. But when you learn that emotional regulation, it's such a powerful tool.
I think emotions, all we have that separates us from the machines. I really think that's our special source. That's our big thing. That's what it is to be human. Yeah. When you see those sci-fi movies and the aliens don't have emotions, they're just sort of transactionally extracting resources from, you know, a planet somewhere. And I think, all right, yeah, emotion does have its negatives at time, and it can lead to war and all sorts of negatives. But in a positive sense, I've seen a couple of test matches that sort of go on to the Monday in the fifth day, and at 10 a.m. people are jumping around. Like, everyone else is at work sort of yearning for coffee to get going, and guys are jumping up and down like they won the lotto. And it's like, what else can do that? Yeah. You know, a decent emotional slow build-up run chase, or you're slowly hunting down their last wickets and there's tension in the air. But there's a scientific side of it as well, particularly when you go out. Like, why do we go out to these stadiums? And it's because oxytocin gets generated in the air. There's a communal drug of being around people. People feel it in concerts at probably even a higher level, because you're packed in like sardines and everyone knows pretty much.
I don't know if music has the same ups and downs. And
I think I've been to concerts that I loved. It does. I don't think it compares to sport, because it doesn't have the seasonal. Yeah. Like, the thing about sport is you got to face up when you're terrible as well. A musician, you just go, oh, I've got a sore throat. But that schedule gets announced, and you've got to go and, you know, tackle that 120-kilo guy, and no one cares about your sore throat.
Exactly.
You're on the ship. You've got your job to do. No one, unless you are literally can't do it. But I think the Vikings called it burning the boats, where if they wanted to invade somewhere and they really wanted to, it was make or break. They would just burn the boats behind them, so there was nowhere to run back to. You get the best out of someone when their back's to the wall. And sport, you see that. And the seasons I love are the ones where someone's 0-17 and just having a shocker. The coach is fired. They've had a mutiny.
You but love those them? Guys, not as a
I
fan,
love them,
surely.
But there's always an 0-17 in every one of the, like, of at the bottom of the NFL. The NRL's had the West Tigers, and you know, they've achieved a disproportionate amount of media share because of it. But the people still turn up. The players still turn up, because they know there is sunlit uplands down there. Like Parramatta fans, I'll give it to you.
Yeah, well, when you were talking before about that intoxicating energy you get only at the footy, being a season ticket holder, I've had many days where I'm like, I just don't want to go today. And then drag myself there with the family, and you get there, and with the old Parramatta Stadium, you had to walk over this little hill, and the moment you walk over that hill, like, it would hit you, and you'd be like, oh, that's why I come. Like, there's nothing like it, even on losing seasons.
Well, I can't. People, have you ever heard anyone rave about church like they rave about Leichhardt Oval? You know, as a spiritual experience.
Yeah, nothing.
And people don't like it, but sport is the new religion. Stadiums are the new cathedrals, and it's just people get, and some people combine traditional religion with sport, and good on them. But for a lot of people that have walked away from what it once was, you know, an all-encompassing, the main thing in their life, and balanced out, sport has filled a huge gap for meaning and for purpose and for meeting people and being part of a tribe. You're walking in the same colours for social cohesion purposes. If you're sitting next to someone in a Balmain Tigers Parramatta Eels jersey, you're positively disposed to that person from the outset. All of a sudden, like, oh, geez, we're in the same tribe, and we've suffered the same post-1986 horrors in your case. Mm. Like, literal kids that are born in 87, I don't know how old that makes you, but it's got to be 40s.
39, actually.
Yeah, it's got to be 39.
It's 40 years this year. Thanks for bringing it up.
You haven't seen a flag. But when Parramatta plays Canterbury, there's an equal amount of para fans. They're all fanatic. They all love and they all believe. What else delivers that in all the face of logic on earth?
Absolutely.
If there was anything else that you were following that was such a dud in your life, if it was a piece of software, you'd go and strangle the manufacturer and say, how are you even putting that product out? But sport is the one thing we will suffer through. And the teams that suffer, I love their fans the most. That's why I love the war. I love these guys. It's like every year they loom, they fade. You've the 39-year-old can go to YouTube and look at highlights of them carrying the shield. But the Wires don't have that. So I wish nothing but a premiership on those guys. I love them.
Well, I've got a bit of a soft spot for the Tigers fans too, I think, for that same reason. My young fella, the first 8 years of his life, he never saw a New South Wales win the State of Origin. He was born the year of the start of it. And he's
Daddy, these Maroon guys are bullies. They always bash us.
Oh, we just stopped watching. Last year's final series, as a neutral, I actually remember turning to my wife at one point after just watching epic game after epic game. Might have been the prelim final that went to double extra time. And just going, like, where else can you get this? Like, this is theatre like nothing else. So good.
Yeah, well, it's the ultimate reality TV, isn't it? And it's not some, like, Huthdongme Mango on an island. It's stakes. When you see that guy on the field, it's an earned right to be there, not a casting call. He's come up through, and we know that brutal pyramid that they've got to go through. And that's why people pay their money. People are like, why does sport get so much money in government funding? Because it's the truth. People commit to whole seasons. People commit to being to elite. They commit to being the very, very best they can be. They commit to get along with people they don't even like. You know, it's a sport. I remember reading something, and I just had an epiphany when I was researching for my book on Olsen Filipina and the whole Pacific Revolution in rugby league. The 1985 team was this incredible Kiwis team, and they had lost to the Aussies in New Zealand for 14 years, and they beat them. And one of the guys I interviewed, an actor called Oscar Keitley, quite a famous actor in New Zealand, really super cool guy, been in a lot of stuff. And he said seeing the white guys and the Pacific guys hugging each other after a try and just being this cohesive, unstoppable unit, you know, the sum of the parts, much greater than the sum of the parts. And they were able to slay, and Olsen was able to slay King Wally. It was carnage. And he said, when I saw them hugging, it gave me permission to go and hug a white guy and be friends with white guys, because we had these role models showing Pacific and Anglo teamwork and Maori teamwork together. And it gave me permission, and you see that role model. It's and power. even in my other book, Celestial Footy, there's a story of a guy called Les Fong. They called him Chopsticks, Captain Courageous, probably the most famous Chinese Australian Aussie rules player. And he played State of Origin for Western Australia and played in Perth. And there was an Asian kid there, was a boarding school getting beaten up. And he said, I brought up Les Fong. How can you beat me up? Because, you know, Les Fong's Chinese and I'm Chinese. And Les Fong had such an impact that these guys stopped bullying him.
Wow. And I was like,
and there you have it. It's there's all these things that trickle down from sport, from role models. It's so complex. And people can say what they want, but the fact that there's billions and billions and billions of dollars in sport means it is real. The market is speaking. The people are speaking. It's their thing. Now, what we have to watch is the politicization of sport. Mm-hmm. How much is it to be used as a platform for other things? Or as the great Michael Jordan once said, Republicans buy sneakers too. You know, you just keep it out of sport. If we lose the last bipartisan endeavor that we share as people, if we lose that, we are truly caricatures at 100 metres just throwing rocks at each other without any chance of common or middle ground. So sport has an incredible amount of heavy lifting to do. And yes, it's clumsy, it doesn't work all the time, but if we can sit next to each other and not worry about Trump or Kamala or Albo or Susan Ley or whoever and just suspend that for 180 minutes, then sport is working an incredible magic.
Absolutely. Music too. I noticed Huda Gurus posted something yesterday complaining that one particular group using their song, and they may, I don't know if they'd regret it, but I've never seen, it was like, you know, we talked about the carnage on comments, but mate, people were coming for them, and they were coming for them hard, and the 95% were all like, just stick to playing music and quoting lots of different people from the past, similar sort of quotes, like, it's not your job.
Same as Springsteen. Well, that's it. And we've learned. We learned in the last election. All the celebrities came out. They were paid to support the Democrats and had no impact. People are tired. We love that you are a brilliant quarterback. But unless you are a learned historian on the issue, because everything is complex and there's two sides and one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. These are all established principles. If you're going to wade in, get ready to be sliced apart if you're not an expert, because people get really offended by these are complex things and you have huge gravitas through your reach and network. And, you know, as we said before, people go through different life stages. What you think at 20 is very different to what you think at 30 and 40. So just have some balance. But I don't want to hear from a singer. Springsteen was booed off the stage. You know, he's got a heavy blue-collar working class demographic, his fans, and he was, you know, just wading in on things. Man, just sing your songs. I know you're a celebrity, but we don't care. And I think Ricky Gervais did that. Gervais did the, you know, the greatest 10 minutes of video of all time when he torched everyone at the Golden Globes. Like, just accept your water and muck on. We don't want to hear your virtue signaling nonsense. It's too much. Yeah. Or be on a single cause for 10 years and show such depth of commitment that we're happy to listen. But you're just having random utterances that you just picked up from a friend from Instagram messages.
Yeah.
We're not interested, and shut up. Just, you know, just dribble the basketball in many ways. Unless you, again, if you want to become a learned expert, really get into it, we're all good. But just random utterances from a shiny castle, it's done. We're done.
Yes,
everyone's, because we're all citizen journalists now. Everyone can investigate. Everyone can check in. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah. Gone are these the argument over facts, because you can look them up.
There's one more thing in sport that's really, really underrated. And that is the amount, unbelievable amount of good content about it. Fictional books, biographies. I just watched this thing on. Might have been Apple, called Chad Powers. It's this NFL, and so like a bad Santa meet. What's it like? A bad Santa meets Ted Lasso. It's about a quarterback who is just an absolute, you know, everything you don't want in a college quarterback is chasing girls and not taken seriously, just living the high life like, you know, all of us might do in his position. But he gets dropped. He, you know, has that fatal time and he gets dropped and he's just sort of mooching around and then he puts on makeup, Mrs. Doubtfire style, and then goes and rejoins. But he has to totally reshape his personality. And his new personality is like a country hick type out of the backwoods. And he likes the new character. He gets to be this new person. He's got the makeup on. But it makes no sense. But it's the most inspired thing I've felt since Ted Lasso in sport. And men and masks and, you know, if we could be someone else rather than this preordained thing we're given to us to be, you know, would we take that up? I know it's six eps, but it's just got
Chad Powers. Chad Powers. I'll have to have a look at that.
Chad Powers. It's comedy. Hmm. It's got an actor. Sometimes I fall behind in actors, but there's a guy called Glenn Powell who's the main actor, and he's, I think he created it himself, and it is, like, you just can't help watching. It's a comedy as well, which is great, so it keeps it going. But I heard Kevin Costner talking about Chad Powers. I couldn't recommend anything more if you like that Ted Lasso inspiration. What sport can do? And he's a bad. Mm-hmm. As I said, it's bad Santa meets Ted Lasso. So he's not. It's not. He's not a wholesome guy. Well, the new guy is kind of wholesome. He's created for himself. But it's just a beautiful contrast. And I like exploring things like that. That you know, sport can often bind a sort of person to an archetype, and it's difficult to. And we all have multiple identity markers, not just that one thing. But back to sport content, I rewatched The Natural with Robert Redford. It's just unbelievable the storylines that sport, and that gets into my stories. You know, I'm basically a professional storyteller these days for my company and using sport. And there's so many, we have these storytelling archetypes hardwired into us. Sometimes they're biblical, the prodigal son, David and Goliath, you know, the classic underdog, the Cinderella story, rags to riches, the little train that could, the ugly duckling that turns up and then, you know, sprouts and becomes beautiful. All these story archetypes are hardwired into our brains, and I've mapped 40 of them, 40 of these storytelling archetypes that sport covers. So what we're really most interested in, we don't even know it subconsciously, is the fact that sports are a Catherine wheel spitting out storytelling archetypes. In one team, you might have 10. You might have the second coming, the redemption, the favorite of all, the redemption story. I just posted on LinkedIn, it went nuts the other day, the guy that drops the sitter at first slip. Irish cricketer, and everyone's down, the bowler's down on his knees, the world's ending, and the next ball he takes a classic. And it's like nothing else in life can deliver that in that sort of time. You can have a redemption in a work situation, but it takes 5 years. You know, you can't do it next ball. You got to prove them all wrong and go off and my startup's going to make it and whatever. And sport just gives all of these storytelling archetypes. And that's why sponsors want to get involved in sport, so they can slap a brand on these stories. Now, a lot of sports don't do storytelling well, which is amazing, but they all sit on this as an incredible upside moving forward. And then you find out what sport is delivers the ultimate archetype, which is the hero's journey. And the hero's journey was every storyteller worth his salt knows the hero's journey. It's sourced from Joseph Campbell's book, which is The Hero of a Thousand Faces. Joseph Campbell, that book was considered the best book of the 20th century, and Joseph Campbell is the most incredible man, incredible brain. And he wrote this book where he studied 200 ancient cultures and all of their stories that had been recorded either oral tradition or passed down through text. And he said, unbelievably eerily, they all followed big stories, the big stories of each culture followed what they called the monomyth, and that is one similar archetype called the hero's journey, and that is the reluctant hero, and that's a huge part. No one wants the blustering loud, the reluctant hero that has a special skill, gifted, nurtured, however, but they have the ace skill that can help the tribe. They get a tap on the shoulder, we need you to use your skill set to take us, your bravery, your sword play, your diplomatic skills, your language skills, your athletic prowess, your spying skills, your ability to move at night, whatever that may be. And we need you. And then, no, I'm not interested. I'm here taking care of my mum or whatever. And no, tap, tap, tap again. The hero finally agrees, makes the great leap into the unknown, arrives, faces the road of trials, whatever that road of trials may be. Mentors appear out of nowhere to help guides as a reward for you taking that great. You get to the cave where the dragon is finally at the end of the journey. The dragon's going to change it all. You slay the dragon. You get the magic elixir from the cave. You bring it back to the tribe. The tribe lives happily ever after and sings songs about that. Those guys are never unsung heroes. They are always sung heroes. Yeah. Now, I was shocked when I heard that Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and Nemo, all of these films had been written directly in line with the hero's journey cheat code. which is embedded into our brains from thousands of years of campfire retells. There's one story that makes it through the campfire or has made it through the campfire at pace, and that's the hero's journey. Now, sport provides unbelievable. So in Star Wars, Luke was the young kid that had, you know, some magic, perceived magic and ability to fly, or could be a future, you know, whether it's for the Parramatta Eels or the Rebels. In Star Wars, it's the same deal. You put stock in some new talent. Takes off on the journey. Obi-Wan appears out of nowhere as a reward for him taking on that journey. Sport provides relentless hero's journeys. We don't know it, but we're just being, every single one of the Parramatta players is a hero's journey that had to take a leap. And part of that leap is risking failure. You know, putting yourself up for selection. That day when you see the team list go up on the wall and you're not on that list, it's like, do you ever get over that?
Yeah.
You know, you do actually. you turn up and play for reserves next week. And it's just, and that's what sport is.
Yeah.
I find sport, there's this whole thing. You've got the hero's journey storytelling under this sport. You've got this content ecosystem. Like Drive to Survive, one piece of content, one series, has completely revolutionized a new audience. It's just, and why? Because we got to know the players, and all the players are on their own hero's journey. How they got into that thing, supported by 60 crew there, supported by factory innovating in 0.01% terms of improvement. But we want to hear those stories, and that's why we pay money, because we believe in those stories. You know, when you try and market an event where people don't know the players and they don't know the players' stories, it's very, very, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, spot on.
So, and this content, all of this sport content's unbelievable. Chad Powers, the natural, Bull Durham, baseball, incredible. It's, or even just a doco, an old doco of the All Blacks winning in 86 or, you know, whatever year they won, that was a breakthrough year. It's so relentless, so all-encompassing, and everyone gets leveled. Doesn't matter how good you are. I mean, seeing Michael Jordan play for the Washington Wizards, or whatever they called at the end.
Yeah.
It was just like, thank you for doing that, Michael, because you didn't quit on top and deny yourself the same ravages that happened to us all, the decay of skills.
Mm.
You actually squeezed every bit out of it and humiliated yourself playing baseball. Yeah. You went from the greatest player of all time just to being a roadie AAA guy, got one home run, you know, oh, good old boy spitting tobacco, just putting heaters past Michael Jordan so they can tell their grandkids about stories. But he was prepared to open himself up to that learning phase again. And there's nothing I respect. Michael Jordan was given a gift in basketball, but that Birmingham baseball run was the thing I respect him for the most.
Man, that's cool. That if you've done any business, you would come across a story brand many times. I'm going to have to go check the original. I've taken a lot from, Donald Miller book. I'm sure you're familiar with that one, the Building a Story Brand. And he sort of takes it a few steps forward, and there's like the internal problem, the external problem, the philosophical problem that needs to be solved. Yeah, and he said any movie that you've watched that doesn't have that hero's journey, that's the movie you walk out of and go, what the hell was that?
Because just a random thrown together of scenes or a guy just walking through.
Yeah.
But the hero's journey is fascinating. And we don't know that we're being served these story archetypes every time we follow a team. And heaven help you think you're relatable to some guy. You'll follow that guy or girl through thick or thin. You'll chase them through teams because, you know, you feel like you're part of their you've paid money to be part of their journey. It's wild just to see that recreated in. And we're not even in, really, sport-passionate cultures. We think we are, but it's nothing compared to Brazil and soccer or ice hockey in towns in Canada, where the thing is so embedded in every corpuscle and sinew and fibre of the town's being. It's the wildest thing. And our native communities, the sport, this thing that able to get them off the reservation there or the mission here, it just has a higher... Yeah, all right, we'll fork up our money for season ticket memberships. But there's just, we're in a like an 80, maybe parts of Aussie rules actually gets, I think, to Ice Hockey Canada, some towns with Aussie rules where the farmers will dedicate the produce of ex-paddocks to pool into a co-op to get a captain coach down to change the fortunes of the town. That's where you think, whoa, we're really on something galactically special here.
You mentioned those sort of athletes from the different parts of the world. I was going to ask you, because you mentioned Reese Walsh before, and that intercept, which was like, it's almost like an instinctive move. Like in those moments, it's like, you could say courage to take that on. But you've done a lot of work in advocacy and multiculturalism through life and sport. Have you seen that, like guys like the Big O, like is there a, almost like a, not about spiritual, but a instinctive side of how they play, or more connected to that sense of spirit that allows them to do those things, those freakish things that maybe, you know, us mortals can't do?
I think it's that mix. So what we've done, we've taken, or we were once instinctive, the Anglos were once instinctive cultures ourselves, but we brought structure and discipline and governance and you see in sport people having to reteach instinct to kids have been too subsumed by the machine.
Yep.
And in many ways, like people with AI now, and you stop your thinking and you just outsource your thinking to the crowd.
Like your post this morning about the Russian Premier League coach has been fired because everything he was doing was from ChatGPT. Fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's well, that's the thing. We've got to work out where we humans can still exist with the machines. And this is definitely one area, the management of emotional humans, ChatGPT can't do. And I'll give Graham Lowe as I always use him as the great example, the old Kiwis rugby league coach. So Olsen Filipina, you know, shy Māori Samoan player, came across in 1980 to play in Sydney. And he came across at 23, so he was a free spirit that entered that system there. The Sydney coaches couldn't get the best out of him. They'd love an Olsen. Now, they'd love an instinctive play that you can't guess what they're going to do. That's the dream in rugby league now. Because if how can the defence know if the guy doesn't? The guy doesn't know. You can't plan for that guy. That's the X factor. That's the key man variable. But Olsen arrived over here, and the Australian coaches thought, shouting at him, you know, under what was the normal way, you give someone a spray, was the way Australians did things. And you got humiliated, your ears burned for a little bit, you looked around, your teammates looked down, you took your spray, you copped it on the chin, and you moved on. But we've learnt that that doesn't work with Pacific, Polynesian, Melanesian, Māori people. They have such trust for their elders that to be abused like that in public, you lose face and you feel like you've been ultimately humiliated by someone you would never talk back to. It's a breach of trust, and it's a breach of being a second father, which a lot of the Polynesians look at their coaches as. So the big thing about Olsen was, under Sydney coaches, he was okay. He's actually much better than the media let on. He was seen as hot and cold, rocks or diamonds, whatever the word they put, the label they put on him. But under Graham Lowe, he was simply unbelievable. He spanked, he thrashed Wally Lewis, the only guy that owned Wally on every metric in that three test series. He won the man of the series in a losing team, in a Kiwis Kangaroo series, that should say it all.
Mm.
But seeing Olsen sit in a muddy Carlaw Park and just carve up King Wally, I want to know, what did Graham Lowe do? Did he supercharge this guy? And everyone was saying, oh, he should wear a Kiwis jumper under his Balmain jump and he'll play better, blah, blah, blah. But no, that's a cop-out. That's lazy. How did Graham Lowe do it? Well, Graham Lowe understood Polynesians. You never, ever shout in public. If you're going to do anything, it's private. If you're going to flog them, if you have if you're going to do it in a group so everyone feels. You talk to the mother. When he was going to move Olsen from center to 5'8", he called Olsen's mother Sissy. They talked for an hour. Then Graham Lowe came back and said, I've just talked to your mother for an hour. She thinks you can play 5'8", and she thinks you can beat, on your day, you can thrash Wally. And Olsen's like, yeah, you know, he's ready for battle. Yeah. Do you think Frank Stanton's ever going and calling the mother? Any coach? But it's interestingly, in a DNA sense, Graham Lowe said he learned everything from the great Jack Gibson. Everything about personalized player management, cutting a personal plan for everybody, being the second father, the priest, the best friend, the worst friend, the whole thing. Whereas in the old days, the guys would just rock up, throw a few tactics at them, wouldn't get to know the player because you were scared to drop them or whatever. But now it's completely, unless you're very close friends and understand the full family situation, you're not going to get the best out of Pacific players, and increasingly Anglo players as well. Everyone's a bit more sensitive now. No one wants to be shouted at and humiliated. We're all moving into a better world in that respect. So the management of humans through sport to be like that ship example. Ship is if you don't do it, you die. And sport is if you don't do it, we don't win. And we've wasted a year effectively in binary terms. Hmm. So it just delivers so much on so many levels. And that's why it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Netflix is going to be in live sports soon because they realize now in the AI world, AI is the... We're entering an era of massive distrust. And live sport will be, and live anything, even plays are going to come back in. Everything you can see with your own eyes that's immutable is going to exponentially increase in value.
100%. I saw a post recently, it might have even been from you, and it was, I think it might have been Gary Vee, and he was talking about, because he's often talking about trends, and he said the two big things is exactly that. It's live events where people can come together, and the other thing is events without phones. He said more of the younger generation, I know my son's like that, he's got himself off all socials and he's not sort of stuck on his phone like most people, but there's more and more from that generation who are switching off. He just spent 5 days hiking in Kosciuszko, like, man, I would never have been doing that sort of stuff at that age. And I think as these trends often come from the youngsters first, they were the first to embrace it, but maybe they're going to be the first to get us off and help us build more of these spaces where, yeah, there's trust is a key element.
Well, you're right. They're now starting to slowly market cricket as a half day off your phones.
Really, that's good. Cricket's
boringness, perceived boringness, is now going to, in the terms of cycles, is going to come around as a good thing. You park presence. Your kid with cricket, you leave at 7:30, you don't get back to 1 in kids cricket, and you're just out in that green grass, forcing yourself to be in the present or daydream, whatever you're doing. But cricket's boringness is going to it's going to come good in this world where parents want extended time. Mandated where you can't go near a machine even if you want to.
That's good. So,
well, it's funny, there's always new winners and losers as the paradigms change. But sport, again, the thing about sport is it provides a season schedule, provides the consistent interaction. And if you show up, you have to be friends or know them at the end of it. There's no choice in the matter. You're scoring, you got rosters to do this, you see other kids, parents supporting your kid, you're supporting other parents' kids. That meshing can't happen any other way unless there's a season or a schedule, I believe, yeah. Where you develop deep relationships that are built on trust. You can't do it through coffees. There's no stakes in coffees. There's no losing. You're just sitting there, you know, having a nostalgic waffle or what are you doing for work or how's the kids? Yeah. And I do my fair share of coffees, but I'd rather them coffees be relating to a project or something exciting that's going on. Waffling about, you know, having a laugh about, you know, pranking the year 10 maths teacher is that's one thing I've happily moved beyond. I'm just relentless forward looking guy.
So good. Patrick, mate, I've enjoyed this chat. Like we took a while to hit record because I was enjoying the chat so much. I'm looking forward to chatting with you again, and you've been very generous with your time and your storytelling. We'll make sure we get the links to both your books in the show notes so people can check them out. But like I said, for those watching and listening, make sure you jump on to Patrick's LinkedIn because you'll see some of the greatest stories in sport. But I think the thing that really gets me is that you've got that ability to connect with the audience in a way that doesn't happen a great deal across a lot of sports journalism. And for that, I'm, truly thankful. Thank you, mate.
No, my pleasure. And it's just about not being too serious as well. We have a short journey here, and we've been gifted sport as this amazing thing that can, you know, even bring you and I together, and you're on the same path. Sport is life. It's a beautiful, great podcast you're doing. I believe it. I believe sport's our salvation, and I believe it's our last bipartisan gathering ground that has an importance now that it's never had ever in history. And anyone that's pushing that side of it, I'm fully support. So well played.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.
All right. Good luck.
This conversation with Patrick is a powerful reminder that sport isn't just something we watch or play. It's something we belong to. It gives us structure when life feels messy, hope when things feel stuck, and a reset when we need to start again. From the hero's journey to redemption arcs, from community footy to elite sport, what really stood out is how sport helps us express emotions, build resilience, and find meaning in ways very few other parts of modern life still do. Whether you're a sports fan, a parent on the sideline, a former player finding your next chapter, or someone who still feels that buzz of a new season, a fresh start, the lesson is simple. Sport shapes who we are long after the final whistle. If this episode resonated, share it with someone who loves their sport and understands it's more than just about winning. It's time to take what you've heard and put it in action. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sport is Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.